Hello, everyone. I'm Drew.
I'm Bailey.
I'm Lacey.
And we're sarcastic, so let's get sinister.
I don't like this case because of the pictures on the first slide.
Yeah.
So, because it looks like a young child.
A boy, a young boy.
Well, maybe this is just the beginning. Maybe he grows up.
He doesn't.
Oh, I said
So,
maybe.
I'm gonna preface this by saying that today it's a big one. I heard about this case and it really like stuck with me. I think it's probably because I have a child that's the same age as James, but there's not going to be a lot of room for sarcasm. So just,
Be supportive.
yeah, I mean, if you can find a spot to sneak it in, go for it. Because this is going to be a real heavy case, and any kind of coping mechanism that we can get through it, pepper it in the best you
Okay.
can.
I'll try to be really sarcastic towards Lacey.
Perfect. Yeah, mock
I'll take
Lacey.
it.
That's
I'll
good.
take it on James's behalf.
So I'm going to be telling you about James Bulger. Bulger. Bulge. Bulger. Bulger. James Patrick Bulger was born on March 16th, 1990, at Fazakerley Hospital in Liverpool. So he's English. He was born to Ralph and Denise Bulger. He had large blue eyes, a beaming smile, and sandy brown hair. He was named after Ralph's late father, who died of cancer shortly before James's birth. He enjoyed music and loved dancing and making people laugh. He was Ralph and Denise's rainbow baby. In June 1988, so 2 years before James was born, Denise gave birth to a little girl whom they named Kirsty. She was born stillborn.
Oh.
So when James arrived, happy and healthy, Denise and Ralph were overjoyed. He was a happy little boy and the apple of his parents' eye. I mean, look at how cute he is.
Don't want to.
Oh, okay, well then don't,
Too late, I looked.
I guess.
Shut up, Lacey.
There you go.
Nice. So every paragraph will just shut up, Lacey. Denise grew up in a happy working class family in Kirkby, Liverpool. She was the second youngest of ready 13 children.
Too many.
How what year is this?
She was
Unbelievable.
like 22 in 1989. So she would have been born in not
56, 57.
67. Yeah.
Okay, like post-World War II, like everyone just popping out babies.
That when the baby boom happened?
No.
No.
Happened in the 50s.
I was gonna
She
say
so
World War II ended long before 67, but we can go with that.
Yeah, that's
That they're
why
still
she's
horny
a
years later.
she's a Korean War Vietnam baby.
There you go.
They had seven boys and six girls. When Denise was 18, she met Ralph Bulger. They quickly fell in love and moved in together. 2 years later, Denise was pregnant with Kirsty. The day Kirsty was born, Ralph proposed to Denise and she accepted. They were married on September 16th, 1989. At that time, Denise was pregnant again with James, and Ralph did his best to look after her as they were both terrified of losing another baby. So, knowing what happened to the Bulgers' firstborn makes this already tragic and devastating story, in my opinion, even worse. So, trigger warning for all of our listeners who don't want to listen about a really upsetting murder committed by also very upsetting murderers.
Oh no.
I want to begin by reading you the inscription on James's tombstone. Our beloved son, James Patrick Bolger, born 16th March 1990, died the 12th of February 1993. There is not a day that goes by that we think of you and cry. You brought us so many happy days. We will always love and remember you, James. May God keep you in his care until the day we get there. Little innocent babe. Love, hugs, and kisses, mom and dad.
That's gonna so tiny.
No, doesn't that just break your heart, that inscription? So, if you were able to do the math there, James died about a month before his third birthday. So on Friday, February 12th, 1993, James accompanied his mother and her brother's fiance on the cold and miserable day to the New Strand Shopping Center in Bootle. Denise had asked Ralph to take James for the day, but Ralph had plans to help Denise's brother with some handiwork, and he was concerned about James getting hurt around all the tools. Later, Ralph said that the biggest regret of his life was not taking James with him that day. James started the day feeling happy and bubbly as usual, but as the day went on, in typical toddler fashion, James became tired and cranky. They hadn't brought their stroller, so he kept trying to break free from Denise's hand and go exploring. At a children's clothing store, he tossed clothes around, and at another store, he grabbed candy and juice before Denise could intervene. It was at this point when Denise decided it was time to take James home. She just needed to grab some chops from the butcher for dinner. They entered the butcher shop hand in hand and remained that way until Denise had to pay for her purchase. She let go of James's hand, grabbed her purse, and quickly paid for the meat. As soon as the transaction was complete, she reached down to take hold of James's hand again, only to discover James was gone. So now I'm going to tell you about these two boys. Robert Thompson was born August 23rd, 1982. He was the fifth of six boys. Hold on a second.
What's happening in your house?
Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I can't tell what it is.
I don't know what it is.
Real loud, but it's weird.
It's like paranormal activity. She's gonna get like sucked away in another room.
Who is he making coffee right on the other side of the wall?
Oh, what a weird coffee.
Why is he making coffee at 9 o'clock at night?
Loud.
Because he works overnights.
Well,
when you were talking, I didn't hear it. It was just when you paused.
So that was like a little palate cleanser, I would say. Me going off into the kitchen to check for coffee.
Fucking Lewis.
Yes. So Robert Thompson was born on August 23rd, 1982. He was the fifth of six boys born to Robert Sr. and Ann Thompson. Robert Sr. was an alcoholic and physically abusive towards Anne. Both Robert Sr. and Anne came from abusive families, so when they married at 18 years old, beatings were sadly not unfamiliar to either of them. Robert Sr. would beat Anne in front of her boys, and she then would beat her sons, reportedly with sticks and belts.
Sure.
Among the children, the oldest would beat his younger brother, and that brother would turn and beat up the younger one. It was just like a really, like, dad would beat mom would beat oldest, old would be, like, although mom would beat all of them. But then the oldest would beat up the younger one would beat up the youngest, that kind of thing.
You know, you can stop the cycle of abuse by just not abusing your kids.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay.
So Robert, being one of the youngest in the family, he was often assaulted by his parents and all of his older brothers. Mm-hmm. To survive, Robert would first try to lie or cry to get out of beatings before accepting his beating with defiance. It's sad. So we can be like the other podcasts that we all listen to. We can be sad for the child, but, you know, he does grow to do terrible things. You'll see.
Ed Kemper went through shit too, and
You can be sad for the child, but then that doesn't excuse their behavior later on.
Yeah.
Of Robert's brothers, one was taken by CPS for abuse. One became a master thief, taking Robert under his wing. One brother became an arsonist as well as a suspected pedophile. One brother regularly threatened his teachers with violence. Eventually, one brother ran away from home to stay at a voluntary care center, and a couple of the other brothers attempted suicide. So none of them were doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I did like that CPS only took one of the kids, from what I read.
He's the one that was complaining.
He complained the most, and CPS was like, fine, I'll just take him. The others can handle it. The Thompson name was very familiar to the police and social workers, which caused the boys to grow to despise authority. When young Robert was about 5 years old, his father abandoned the family. Robert's mother, Anne, was devastated. She became depressed and began to drink heavily before allegedly trying to kill herself via pill overdose.
Yeah, Robert, it's really depressing when your abuser leaves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she, like, that's what she, when she was a kid, her, she'd get beat by her parents.
Yeah.
Like, this
so
was
she probably
just
likes his love. Yeah.
Plus, you know, he left her alone with six kids and, like, they're arsonists, pedophiles, thieves. I mean, I might be
I mean,
sad
it's
too.
Five kids because one left.
It's true.
So.
Robert would help his mother in the kitchen and help babysit his youngest brother, baby Ben, who was born from a different father. So after Robert Sr. left, Anne got pregnant with another baby. Robert was described as being clever, sly, and street smart, with no reports of violence in his childhood. No one described him as being aggressive. Like I said, he would babysit his baby brother, Ben, and he shared a strange bond with his other younger brother, Ryan. So Robert Sr. had six boys. Robert was the second to last. Ryan was the last one. And then Anne had another baby, baby Ben. So he would babysit baby Ben, and then he had a strange bond with his other brother, Ryan. At night, they would lie in bed together, sucking each other's thumbs.
That's cute if you're little enough.
Yeah.
You get older.
You know what I mean? I think that they bonded over the fact that they weren't as violent as their brothers, mm-hmm. and they received little attention due to the large family size. And also, being the youngest, they received most of the beatings.
Yeah.
He was a poor student, often skipping class, but when he did attend, he was not regarded as a troublemaker. Teachers thought he was shy and quiet, but manipulative. Because he bore the name Thompson, adults expected very little from him, and peers were afraid of him. He did not have many friends. One of his few friends was John Venables. Any comments about Robert? Okay, so let's move on to John. John Venables was born August 13th, 1982. So very close in age to Robert, like 10 days apart. He was born to Susan and Neil Venables. Neil worked as a forklift driver, but was often unemployed. John was the middle child and both of his siblings had developmental issues, problems. What's a politically correct thing to say?
Delays, probably. Developmental delays.
His older brother, Mark, struggled with communicating due to a cleft palate, which often left him feeling frustrated and acting out by way of temper tantrums. John's younger sister, Michelle, had a developmental disability. Both John's siblings attended a special school to accommodate their needs. John was often left feeling ignored and envious of the attention his siblings received. Sometimes he mimicked his brother's tantrums as a ploy to get attention.
It's understandable from a little kid.
Yes. John's parents had a tumultuous relationship. They often split up just to reunite again later. they were like off and on all the time. It was very Rachel and Ross.
No.
I think more so. No?
No, Rachel and Ross only broke up like once, technically.
They were like on and off constantly. Whenever he was with another girl, she would like break him up. And whenever he was.
God. Yeah, but they were never like a fit. Okay, fine. Maybe twice.
They were on a break. Anyway, Neil would leave. Then Susan would take the kids to live with her mother. Then Neil would come back only to leave again, and so on. Both parents had a history of depression, and Susan in particular came from a strict and disciplined background. She was often seen physically and verbally assaulting John. So John didn't get enough attention. He was being abused, and he did not have a stable home life, is how I would describe his main issues. Teachers started noticing John's attention-seeking behavior in 1991. It started off benign. He was like 8, I think, at this time. He would rock back and forth at his desk, moaning and making odd noises. His teacher moved him to the front of the class. Lacey knows this move, right?
Yes.
Yeah. At the front of the class, he would just knock shit off of his teacher's desk.
That's annoying.
Lacey, how would you react if one of your kids was like rocking so and moaning?
Put him back to the back of the class. You can rock all you want. Just leave my shit alone. So I feel like his teachers probably just ignored him because she was like, he wants attention. I'm not going to give it to him. In return, his behavior escalated. He started banging his head on the furniture and against the wall, or he'd throw himself on the floor. He cut himself with scissors or tore at his own clothing. He would roam around the classroom, tearing down artwork from other students. On one occasion, he stood on his desk and threw things at other children. During another incident, John crept up behind another student and started choking the boy with a ruler. Here. Two adults were needed to separate them. That's how like hard he was holding on.
He needs more than attention at this point. But he needs that for sure, badly.
Yeah, as a result of this incident, he was transferred to another school. None of his teachers considered him a bad kid. They thought he was a sweet child who was just pleading for help. John often bullied other children in the neighborhood. He was bullied by other children in the neighborhood. The other kids would tease his siblings and mock John's imperfections. I think he had like a lazy eye or something that they would make fun of.
I said that's mean.
Yeah, and like also they would make fun of his siblings who had, one had a cleft palate and the other one had a disability.
Yeah.
And he would get really worked up over it, and that would just make them, like that would make them want to keep bullying him. Mm-hmm. 'Cause they thought it was funny how easily he would get worked up. Which I can't fault him for getting upset if they were bullying his siblings. Like,
kids are fucking dicks.
Yeah. That's the theme. That's what this episode should be called. Kids are dicks.
Dicks.
That's the running theme throughout this episode. We should make it on a t-shirt.
Write that down.
Kids are fucking dicks. You could write fucking like how they write. Have you seen the show Kevin Can Fuck Himself?
No.
It's on my list. I've seen clips.
I've watched 2.5 episodes so far. Very much enjoying it. But they, during the opening credits, they have different ways of blurring fuck himself, like the fuck part. The first time they only showed the F. And then it was like a spotlight. They just scrolled over and then you saw the U and the C and the K. But you didn't see the whole word at one time.
Smart.
Yeah. So when John was transferred to the other school, this is when he met Robert. Both boys had grown up being bullied, but together they brought out the worst in each other. They became the bullies. John's parents at least made efforts to correct John's behavior. His mother changed his diet in hopes to calm him down. Maybe she thought he was eating too much sugar, and that's why he was climbing on desks.
She said, I will not give him the attention he needs, but, like, less sugar.
He's having too much protein.
Yeah. His carbs are through the roof.
Oh, my God.
And
that fat content? No trans fat for you, John.
When Robert would come over to John's house, Neil Venables would chase him away. Can you imagine that? Like, your friend comes over to visit, and your dad chases him out.
I just can't get over the fact that his dad's name is Neil, and that just sounds so dorky. Sorry.
I feel like that's some kind of thing from Frasier. Because his brother was a dork, and his name was Neil. I don't know.
I never watched Frasier. That was before my time.
No, I didn't either, but I feel like Dad watched it, and we just, like, subconsciously learned that Neil was a dork. Anyway.
Got it.
Even at school, teachers would try and keep them separated, but unfortunately, the boys began to skip school together and get into trouble. So, I feel like we don't need a palate cleanser from that, because although their backstories are sad, they are dicks. So, you good if we just keep moving?
Yeah.
Okay. On the morning of February 12th, 1993, John left his home in Merseyside to go to school. They were both 10 at this time, 10 years old. Okay. Let that sink in for a second. These boys were 10. Once down the road and out of sight of his house, he ditched his backpack and met up with Robert. Together, Robert and John walked to the Bootle Strand, so this mall had many different names. It was called, like, the New Strand, in Bootle, the Bootle Strand, just the Strand, just, it's all one place.
I like Bootle Strand.
As they strolled through the mall, many salespeople watched them closely. They were dressed in their school uniforms, so they stood out as truants.
Truants.
I know. They used that word so many times in all of my reading, and I loved it. Robert and John began their criminal behavior that day with theft. They pocketed whatever was in reach when the salesperson was looking the other way. They ended up with pockets full of batteries, enamel paint, pens, pencils, a troll doll, fruit, candy, makeup, and other trinkets.
So, like, stealing.
Oh, they want makeup.
Fun of stealing.
They didn't want it. They just wanted to steal. They stole a wind-up toy soldier and played with it on the escalator before tossing it down the stairs. Much of what they stole, they discarded. They didn't really want the stuff. They just wanted to steal.
Again, it's a rush.
In addition to the stealing, they also just terrorized store employees and other shoppers. They kicked a can of paint until it started to leak in one store. They climbed all over the chairs in McDonald's. They kept poking and teasing an elderly woman and then running away whenever she turned around.
That's not funny.
No.
Can you kick a child?
I would have beat them with my cane.
Legit. Jesus fucking Christ.
At one point... All right, so this is the meat and potatoes. At one point in a department store called TJ Hughes, John and Robert were playing with some purses on the floor. They were opening them and then snapping them shut. This attracted the attention of a 3-year-old girl and her 2-year-old brother. Their mother was at the checkout counter making a purchase. She looked over and saw her children start to walk towards John and Robert. She called to them, but they ignored her because they are children. She quickly finished her transaction and followed after her kids. She found her daughter right away and asked her where her brother was. Her daughter responded, quote, gone outside with the boys. The mother rushed outside and yelled her son's name. That's when she saw John and Robert walking away and motioning to her son to follow them. So they were like, come on. When John saw the mother, he froze, then told the boy to go back to your mom. Then they quickly disappeared.
Don't like that.
Here's, you know, security footage of them just being hooligans.
They look so little.
They're 10. They are little. Their next stop was a concession stand. They had hoped to pocket some candy, but the stand was closed. So they stood there together for a moment, thinking of something else to do. That's when they saw a little boy with big blue eyes and sandy brown hair. He was near the door of the butcher shop located next to the TJ Hughes store. The toddler was eating some candy. The boys approached and John said, "Come on, baby." They lured the boy out of the store where John took him by the hand and together the three of them left the shopping center. CCTV captured the moment John Venables and Robert Thompson left the shopping center with James Bulger in hand at 3:42 p.m. It's like reading it is one thing, but then it's like seeing the pictures is like so like goosebumps. Chilling.
Nobody noticed. They were all watching these boys. They were all suspicious that these boys were up to no good. Nobody saw these 10-year-olds, the 3-year-old leave the store. Nobody saw these 10-year-olds walk out without an adult holding on to a toddler.
You are going to be so mad. Are you ready to move on?
They probably think that like he's like their little brother or something.
Yeah. They probably figured it wasn't their problem.
Yeah.
When Denise noticed James's absence, she immediately began to panic. She was directed to the security office where she described her son. Blue coat, gray sweatsuit, blue scarf, and a t-shirt with the word Naughty printed on it. Naughty was the name of a character from a children's book, which was later adapted into a TV show. So, you know what it means. Okay. Security announced James's name and description over the loudspeaker, but no one responded. Denise frantically searched the shops, but at 4:15, she called the Marsh Lane police. Around the same time, Ralph arrived at Denise's mom's house to meet up with Denise and James, as was the plan. Upon walking through the door, Ralph could immediately sense something was wrong. Eileen, Denise's mother, told him, "Ralph, the police have been on and your James is missing. There's a message on the answer phone for you. You need to go to Marsh Lane Police Station." When Ralph arrived at the station, he was first interviewed by police to make sure he didn't have something to do with James's disappearance. When he was finally allowed to see Denise, she told him what happened, how she'd only let go of him for a second and he just vanished. She said, quote, "I saw him by my side and then by the door, and that was it. I ran out to find him, but I never saw him again." So what did John and Robert do with James? John and Robert took James from the Bootle Strand and walked up Stanley Road. So this is the shopping center right here. Here's Stanley Road. They were carrying James at this point because he had begun to fuss and cry for his mother. They took him to the nearby Leeds and Liverpool Canal, which is that little blue bit right there, under a bridge to an isolated area. There, John and Robert joked about pushing James into the water. This is where they first hurt James. So, trigger warning. One of them, they each eventually blamed each other, picked James up, and dropped him on his head. James began to wail, and John and Robert ran away. A woman walked by and saw all three boys, so John and Robert returned to James and said, "Come on, baby," acting as if they were his brothers or like they were trying to help him. At this point, James had a big bruise and cut on his forehead, but he did not flee. He was just a baby and he didn't know any better. When told, "Come on, baby," he again followed John and Robert. As they began to walk again, the 10-year-olds pulled the hood of James's coat up to cover his wound. They held his hand and walked back towards Stanley Road, crossing a busy intersection. The threesome was seen by many witnesses. Some noted the tears soaking James's face. Some noted the cut and blood on his head. Some felt uneasy. But no one did anything. I'm not trying to blame the bystanders. Like at the time, nobody would was suspicious of 10-year-olds. They didn't know what was like really going on. Everyone just assumed they were brothers, and the toddler was just upset. Robert and John didn't really seem to have a plan. They just meandered around, holding James's hand, strolling past shops, offices, and parking lots. One witness saw the boys swinging James by the hands as he walked between them, like, playfully. By now, the three boys had walked over a mile along this busy road in Liverpool. Many drivers witnessed the boys walking together. Many reported that James was visibly upset, crying and dragging his feet. At one point, James tried to run off straight into traffic, but Robert caught him and pulled him back onto the sidewalk. One motorist witnessed the boys pulling the toddler against his will. James was crying and refusing to walk any further. This witness watched Robert kick James in the rib. I don't know why nothing was done about that.
Yeah.
The 10-year-olds carried James awkwardly together, with John holding James's legs and Robert holding James's chest. Can you picture that?
Yeah.
They took him to a grassy area near a reservoir where they sat and rested for a bit. James sat between them. A woman walking her dog nearby witnessed James laughing. Moments later, another woman happened to look out her window and saw John punch James, grab him, and shake him violently. For some fucking reason, she just closed the curtains. Later, the media shamed these witnesses, who were called the Liverpool 38. Do you know why they were called Liverpool 38?
Were there
Because there were
30s?
38 of them. Some of the sightings were understandably ignored. James was laughing and playing in some of them. They seemed like a happy little family. But other sightings where the boys were hurting James or dragging him as he screamed for his mother are mysteries as to why nobody called the police or intervened. One woman actually did approach the group and ask what was wrong with James. The older boys lied and said that they had just found him at the bottom of the hill. The elderly woman, worried about James's injuries, instructed the boys to take James to the Walton Lane police station, located just down the road. The woman pointed in the direction, but was surprised when they got up and walked in the opposite direction. She called after them, but they ignored her and kept walking. Another woman approached that old lady and said that she'd seen the boys earlier, and at that time, James had been laughing, so they're probably brothers and just fine. Later that night, the woman saw the news and called the police immediately to report what she had witnessed. So at least the witnesses are coming forward. Because, like, if you witnessed a kid punching another kid and then you found out what happened later, you might feel inclined to not come forward because then people would shame you.
That makes me wonder how many people saw something and didn't come forward. If you got 38 who did.
Yeah, I mean, they were walking for hours and eventually walked for about like 2.5 miles. So I'm sure there were a lot of witnesses. But I don't know if you guys noticed, but this grassy area that they were hanging out with just seems to be overflowing with women. Just lots of women just coming up to them. Like they were approached by like three different women in this park reservoir. So at this point, it was getting dark when the boys walked down the hill and continued on until they reached County Road. Okay, so in this map that I've provided for you, the arrow, I'm going to go from left to right. First one is the shopping center. Second one is the canal. Third one is County Road. And the fourth one is the Walton Lane Police Station.
Okay.
So they continued on until they reached County Road. By this point, they were nearing 2 miles. Another woman, for the benefit of the story, I'm going to call her Dog Lady, was walking her dog when she noticed the children and asked what was going on. The boys told her that they'd found this lost boy at the Strand and were taking him to the police station. During this conversation, another woman, let's call her Mom, was walking with her daughter and stopped to join the chat. She commented that they had walked a long way from the Strand to Walton's Lane police station. Dawn responded saying that a man had directed them to take James there. Dog Lady asked where they lived, and John replied, "The police station is on our way home." Robert let go of James's hand as if willing to relinquish him, according to one of these women. Dog Lady watched Robert as he looked away, seeming nervous. John instructed Robert to get hold of his hand, so Robert again took James by the hand. Mom asked James if he was okay. James didn't respond, but John insisted that they would find the station and take care of it. This is where I have thoughts, okay? So Mom felt very uneasy about the situation. She could tell that the boys were lying and it was getting dark, so she asked the dog lady to watch her daughter, who was tired, while she escorted James to the police station.
Risky.
Dog lady refused, saying that her dog didn't like children. The boys quickly, while they were chatting, took off with James in hand. Mom called after them, "Are you sure you know the way?" John pointed and said, "I'll go that way, Mrs." So, like, I commend Mom for wanting to intervene and take James herself. But then also, like, you're just going to leave your kid with some random person?
A little
concerned. And also, just walk with them.
Yeah.
If they're insisting on doing it, be like, "Okay, I'm coming with you."
That's a very good point, Lacey. I didn't think of that. I thought just pick up I thought of just pick up your tired kid.
Yeah, bring your kid. Don't leave your kid with a stranger because you're worried about this other kid. You're going to have a whole circle of kidnappings.
Yeah. You saved this one, but now your daughter's missing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have, you know, guys, I have three kids. I routinely carry one on each hip. So in my mind, pop the daughter on one, put James on the other. There you go. Off to the police station. Mm-hmm. Instead of going to the police station, the boys took James into a couple shops. In one, Robert asked the clerk for candy for his kid brother. In a pet store, Robert noticed a fish at the bottom of the tank and told the clerk, "It's dead." The clerk noted how strange it was that John was gripping James's hand, refusing to let him go. Outside, kind of random, a fire had broken out down the street, so the boys stood and watched for a bit before crossing heavy traffic to Church Road West. And I have another map here. It's a little bit zoomed in. So this first is the county road. This road here is Church Road West. Here's the police station again. They're so close. There, they ran into two older boys who knew Robert. Those boys had been playing with trick handcuffs, and upon seeing John and Robert, wanted to try the cuffs out on them. But then they noticed James. They inquired about him, and Robert said he was John's brother, whom they were taking home. Later, one of these boys claimed to have told Robert, "If you don't take him home, I'll batter you." I don't know how much of that I believe. As the three boys continued on, they came to the entrance of the Walton and Anfield Railroad Station. They stopped, turned around, and walked back toward Walton Lane. They stood by and watched the heavy traffic before walking into an alley. As they emerged from the alley, a witness reported that they'd seen James laughing. It was now around 5:30 p.m., and it was dark. They were so close to the police station, but they decided to turn around and go back to the railway. So the third arrow from left to right is that train tracks. Real quick, they'd been walking for 2 hours. I don't know if you've tried walking with a two-year-old for 2 hours. Also, he'd been out all day. And the last thing is that I wonder, like, a lot of people are saying that they saw James laughing. I wonder if he was, like, really laughing or if he was crying.
Mm-hmm.
On the way back to the railroad tracks, John ripped off the hood of James's coat and threw it into the trees. They arrived at the tracks, and their 2.5-mile walk was coming to an end. They found a hole in the fence around the tracks and climbed through, passing James through. They crossed the grass and walked through slabs of white shale to get to the tracks. So here's the trigger warning, okay? They'd reached the tracks at around 5:45 p.m., and this is when their final assault on James took place. Trigger warning. They began to throw paint on James's face, getting it in his left eye and causing him to scream out in pain. It was later theorized by author of the book As If, Blake Morrison, that the paint was used to dehumanize James. John and Robert threw stones at him, kicked him, and beat him with bricks. They pulled off his shoes and pants and hit him with an iron bar or a railway fish plate. When they thought he was dead, they laid his body across the train tracks, covering his head with bricks, and then they left before a train came. John and Robert returned to town and visited a friend who happened to not be home, so they just loitered in this guy's front yard for a while. Eventually, they got bored and wandered over to the video store. The store clerk asked if the boys wanted to retrieve an overdue video for a reward. The boys agreed, left to collect the past due rental, then returned for their reward. Just as they were about to receive this reward, whatever it may be, Susan Venables arrived, furious. She'd been looking for John everywhere. She grabbed both boys and yanked them out of the store, screaming and beating them both. Robert broke free and ran home. Susan hauled John to the police station and asked an officer to lecture him. At home, John was in tears. Susan told John that she was so worried because some maniac had kidnapped a child from the shopping center, and that man could have taken John too. Meanwhile, Robert had run home also in tears. When he got home, he told his mom that John Venable's mom ragged me out of the video shop. Ann Thompson was furious and took Robert to the police station to make a report.
Nobody
Only
else could
Ann.
beat her kid, only her.
Exactly. Only Ann is allowed to beat her children. The officer making the report noticed a small scratch under Robert's left eye, but assumed it was from being beaten by Susan. So, as I mentioned, Susan Venables saw James's disappearance on the news. Many people called the police to report sightings. Police got reports that he'd been spotted by the canal, so they planned to drag the water in the morning. Late that evening, the police were finally able to persuade Denise and Ralph to go home and try to get some sleep. Oh, hold on. So this is a map of where they meandered. Isn't it crazy? And that's the railway. And then this is what a fish plate is. I don't know. When I read fish plate, I didn't know what that meant. Okay, so Denise and Ralph went home, but neither of them could rest. Instead, at 1 a.m. on February 13th, they returned to Bootle with Denise's brothers and began searching for themselves. About that time, technicians who had been working throughout the night on the CCTV images finally made a discovery. James had left the shopping center with two young boys. Police had been, not just police, everybody had been expecting him to have been abducted by an adult, not two boys. This was a relief to Ralph and Denise, as well as some officers, because they believed that this was all just a prank. Like, two young boys wouldn't have abducted a toddler with any real ill intent. They were just joking around, probably. So, like, Ralph told Denise, he's okay. He's gonna be okay. In the morning, divers searched the canal while the search continued on land. The police released images from the CCTV footage to the media, but the images were too blurry for any positive identifications. Ann Thompson did outright ask Robert if that was him in the video. He denied it, but Ann was worried and spoke to her friend about her concerns. She considered taking Robert to the police station. On Sunday, February 14th, the police held a press conference. The media briefing began with a statement. It is now 44 hours since James went missing on Friday, said Detective Chief Inspector Jeff McDonald. We have a sighting of James at around 4:30 p.m. on Friday in the Breeze Hill area of Walton. A lady saw a small boy answering his description with two other boys. We are anxious to trace any more persons who may have knowledge of who these two boys are. Following the press conference, Ralph and some family members met up in Walton and began a new search. After a few hours, Ralph's older brother, Jimmy, offered to go back to the police station to check if there was any updates. As soon as Jimmy arrived, he knew there was an update, and it was bad. The look in the officer's eyes gave it away. So on Sunday morning, February 14th, a train engineer noticed that what looked like a doll was on the tracks. He didn't think much of it. Kids were always laying things on the tracks. But he had a feeling in his gut that was nagging on him, nagging at him. And that evening, he called the police to report it. Little did he know that police had already been notified by that time about a body on the tracks. Four boys, consisting of two brothers and their friends, had been playing on the tracks that afternoon when they saw James. At first, they thought it was a cat, then a doll, torn in two. But soon they realized what it truly was. The four boys screamed and ran down the embankment to Walton Lane Police Station, only 100 yards away. They crashed through the doors and blurted out to the desk sergeant that what they had seen. The search for James was now over. His upper body was hidden from his coat with his coat, while his lower body was found much further down the tracks, completely nude. He had suffered 42 injuries, most to his face and neck. Not true. Most to his face and head. The police thought that perhaps the murderers thought that it would look like an accident, that James had wandered up on the tracks by himself and was run over. Or perhaps they thought that if the train hit James, all evidence would be destroyed. Detective Albert Kirby was lead investigator on the case. They shut down the station and roped off the tracks, putting up shields to block the scene from bystanders and reporters. Because James's body was severed with quite some distance in between, it was as if there were two crime scenes. Police determined that he had been laid by the waist onto the rail with his upper body on the inside of the tracks. They were able to determine that his head had been covered with bricks, although the force of the train disturbed the arrangement. His pants, underwear, shoes, and socks were laid near his head, and his underwear was heavily saturated with blood. Nearby, a 22-pound, 2-foot-long iron bar/fish plate was found with bloodstains. Blood was found on many bricks and stones as well. Also near the body, police found 3 AA batteries and a tin of blue paint. The blood on the bricks, stones, iron bar, and the underwear were all positively matched to James. James had been beaten severely around the head and neck. There were many fractures, cuts, bruises, and severe bleeding. A forensic pathologist, Dr. Alan Williams, counted 22 wounds on James's head and face and another 20 on his body. The wounds were so numerous that a final killing blow could not be established. Dr. Williams determined that James would have already been dead by the time the train hit him, as he had been struck at least 30 times and would have endured a short period of survival after the attack began. The deep bruising on James's head, along with a cut that went down to the skull, and the extensive damage to the back of his head suggested that bricks and the iron bar had been used. James sustained extensive head injuries, including a hemorrhage at the center of his brain. Dr. Williams also noted a severe blow to James's face that left a large bruise and a grooved mark on the area around the right cheek and ear. It appeared to be an imprint of a shoe. Despite the blockers to keep the scene private, the four boys who had discovered the body were already speaking to reporters at the scene. So it became common knowledge that James had been found, severed in two by a train, but police decided to withhold the nature and intensity of James's other injuries from the public. Denise Bolger was still, had gone to the police station when James, that morning, she had gone to the police station, and when James's body was found, she knew something was going on. Nobody like came up and told her, but like the office began to buzz and officers were running around. She overheard that a body had been found and she became hysterical. There was nothing she could do but wait to hear if the body was confirmed to be James. Later, while the police worked the crime scene, mourners from the community made a makeshift memorial for James near the railway. Robert brought a single rose to lay at the memorial.
Hey, Robert.
Robert noticed the television crews filming the mourners and later argued that if he had been involved in the murder, why would he bring a flower for James?
You're right.
It's a good point.
So smart.
Meanwhile, John showed a lot of interest in the story of James's disappearance. Saturday, he asked his mom repeatedly if they'd found him yet. On Sunday, when they found out that James had been found, he expressed concern for James's poor mom. Neil Venables questioned John about the blue paint on his coat. John said Robert had thrown it at him. The news reported that blue paint had been found on the body, but the Venables did not openly suspect John. They might have suspected him internally, but they didn't come out and say anything. The police, what I think is a smart move, checked absentee lists from school and held press conferences in an effort to keep the public calm. A witch hunt developed overnight, with many calling in to report any bad child. Even parents called in to report their own sons. Police brought one 12-year-old boy in as a suspect, and people attacked his house, breaking windows. His family had to be relocated for their own safety.
Jesus Christ.
Well, people were very upset.
I mean, I get it, but like... Yeah. Maybe like, let's terrorize the people that actually did it and be sure that we're terrorizing our people.
Yeah, let's wait and see. A couple days after finding James, the police were running out of leads. Then they received a very intriguing visit. An anonymous woman came to the station to report that her friend, Susan Venables, had a son named John. John had skipped school Friday with his friend Robert Thompson. John had blue paint on his jacket and resembled the boy in the video. Because they didn't really have anything else to go on, the police decided to interview Robert and John. At 7:30, okay, so just to recap, James was kidnapped Friday. They found him on Sunday. At 7:30 Thursday morning, 4 days after James was found, four police officers arrived at the Thompson residence with a search warrant. When Robert saw the officers at his door, he immediately began to cry. The police didn't have to search too long before finding evidence. There was blood on Robert's shoes. Later, DNA tests would confirm the blood belonged to James. When officers arrived at the Venables residence to serve the warrant, Susan opened the door and said, quote, "I knew you'd be here. I told him you'd want to see him for Sagan school on Friday." She thought they were here about the truancy.
All right.
Then she mentioned that John had come home on Friday, quote, "coat full of paint." Officers asked to see the coat in question, which was indeed splattered with blue paint, but also appeared to have a small handprint on the sleeve. Like Robert, John immediately burst into tears. Through sobs, John told the police, "I don't want to go to prison. I didn't kill the baby. It's that Robert Thompson. He's always getting me into trouble."
Fuck you.
He advised the officers that they should talk to Robert, and as they drove him to the station, he repeatedly asked about Robert. Even though the police brought Robert and John into the station, they didn't consider them to be real suspects. They were looking for 13 to 14-year-old boys with violent records, not these two 10-year-olds who were small and still little kids themselves. But they followed procedure and interviewed John at the Lower Lane station and Robert at the Walton Lane station. Both boys appeared nervous, but John was also asking a lot of questions. During fingerprinting, John asked, "Do you leave these on whatever you touch? If you touch someone's skin, does it leave a fingerprint? If you drag someone real hard, do you leave your nails in their skin?" He also asked if Robert was being fingerprinted as well. In addition to the fingerprints, police collected blood, hair, and fingernail samples from both boys. Meanwhile, a shopkeeper called into the station and said that the boys in the CCTV footage may have been in his store that Friday when James disappeared. Officers went to the store and took fingerprint samples that turned out to match John Venables. So I find that like little area, that bit kind of confusing. I assume that the shopkeeper was like, those two boys that look like them on the security camera were here with another boy, and I guess they touched that. But like it was almost a week ago. But they got fingerprints, so. Robert was interviewed on Thursday, the day he was brought in, by Detective Sergeant Phil Roberts and Detective Constable Bob Jacobs. In addition to Robert and the detectives, Ann Thompson and legal representation were also present in the room. Robert was interviewed for 3 days, and for the majority of the questioning, he was completely unflustered. The detectives began their questioning by asking if Robert understood the difference between a truth and a lie. He said that he did, but that didn't stop Robert from lying as much as possible.
Well, once you understand the difference, you can do them easily.
I said he knew the difference, not that he never lied.
Yeah, I want to remind you that Robert was described by his teachers as manipulative.
It's so fucked because he still has like his baby cheeks and everything. Mm-hmm. Like,
I mean, you look at him and you're like, that he wouldn't have hurt anybody.
No.
They asked if he'd gone to school the day of James's abduction, and if he had, where's his homework? When Robert couldn't think of a decent lie to respond with, he'd say something like, "Well, I was there and you weren't," or, "Oh, that's what you think."
Oh, okay.
Eventually, they were able to get Robert to admit to skipping school on Friday with John, and that they had gone to the Strand shopping center. He tried to convince the detectives that he was merely a witness, not a suspect. He said he'd seen James with his mother while John and he were on the escalator. The detective questioned further, wondering if this was true, why Robert would take notice of James and his mother. The mall was full of mothers and children. Robert insisted he'd seen James and Denise Bolger, then he and John left the Strand, went to the library, and then went home.
They also stopped at church, too, on the way home?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, John was being interviewed by a detective constable, Mark Dale. Unlike Robert, John was completely hysterical from the start. He was extremely scared and intimidated by the police. I just want to say, I saw like, one person wrote that, during the interviews, Robert lied and John cried. And I like that. Multiple times throughout questioning, the detectives had to stop because he had become so distressed he could not speak. Another difference between
You know who else is distressed? James's mom.
It's just everybody, really.
Pretty much.
Another difference from Robert, John didn't lie, he just avoided the truth. In the end, John proved to be much more willing to disclose the truth than his partner. Like Robert, John's mother was present in the room. Initially, John would only talk shit about Robert. He was the bad one, the troublemaker. He was into girly things, like playing with troll dolls. He liked the naked troll dolls, the ones that show their bum and that. I don't know if he was trying to imply that he was like a perv, or like why he thought that he should mention that Robert liked the naked troll dolls. John also said how Robert sucked his thumb. He told the police a bunch of random details about Robert, but throughout, he sounded enamored by Robert. Like, the police were like, he was shit-talking him, but it sounded like he was, like, in love with him. He talked about how excited he felt being with Robert and how they would skip school and steal things. But John made it very clear he would never do bad things on his own.
Well, that
At
makes it
one
okay.
point, detectives pulled John's parents aside and asked them to reassure John that they'd love him no matter what. Once they did, John began to admit his involvement. John said on Friday, the day of the crime, Robert wanted to skip school. He said they went to the park, the old railways, and to a cemetery. John said Robert wanted to steal flowers from the cemetery, but John told him no.
Asshole.
Yeah, but John said no.
Okay. Oh, okay. But where was John saying no when they took James?
I also want to say real quick, their stories don't match at all. So
Well, no, because wasn't Robert saying that? Oh, we went to the library and then we went
they went to,
home.
Robert said they went to the mall, then library, then home. John is saying that they went to a park, the old railways, and a cemetery. He said that Robert stole blue paint and threw it at him. The detectives interviewing John and the detectives interviewing Robert all took a break from questioning the boys and conferred with each other. When the interviews restarted, the detectives questioned Robert about John's different story. Robert basically made it seem like John was walking behind him, and therefore he doesn't know what John was doing back there. Like, if you look at the CCTV footage, this is Robert, and John is the one holding James's hand. So Robert was saying, like, look, I was in front. I don't know what John was doing back there. He might
Right.
have taken a kid. I don't know. My head does not turn.
Couldn't stop and look.
When the detectives commented that his jacket matches the boy's jacket in the CCTV footage, Robert responded, quote, "Many jackets get sold the same as mine." And when the detectives asked about John's distinctive jacket, because I guess John had like a mustard yellow jacket that nobody else had, they mentioned him having a very distinctive jacket many times. Robert said, "Yeah, well, he's not walking along with me." So he's basically saying, like, he's not with them in the video, so he's not involved.
Okay. He, you know what? If he actually applied
What a
himself,
friend.
he'd be such a fucking good lawyer.
It's chilling how calm, cool, and collected Robert was by all of this.
Yeah.
He straight up told them that he didn't leave with James. The images show John holding his hand.
I wonder if he just kind of came up with that on the spot, or if even when they were leaving the mall, that was in the back of his mind. He was like, I'm not going to walk next to them. I'm gonna
But
look
like
like I'm a little
that,
slipper from them. I know that it's
that.
not like it didn't actually help him at all, but I wonder if his 10-year-old manipulative brain was like, I need to start setting up my alibi.
I don't know.
I mean, other
I
killers do that too.
still.
They're like, I mean, I wasn't like, I didn't like
Yeah.
touch her or
But
whatever,
yeah,
but.
I was there, but clearly I wasn't anywhere near her.
Yeah, I think that it's just a convenient thing that he's saying. Lacey, because like he didn't have anything else planned that day. They walked around for 2.5 hours all
Yeah,
over.
I don't think, I know that you're not done. I don't necessarily think when they took him they were planning to kill him. I think they were like experimenting and just kind of seeing how much they could get away with.
Right, I think this is a good stopping point.
Oh.
I know, but it's a real bummer of an episode, so
I could use a break.
yeah, it's also very long. I don't want to cut anything out because I feel like it's very important to tell James's story in entirety, and it's gonna take like 2 hours. So I think we should stop now, and we'll pick it up again in like a week or sooner for our Patreons.
Ooh.
Ooh.
subscribe.
Or just Brandon. So with that, that was sinister.
We tried to be sarcastic in some spots.
Yeah, it was hard.
And we do hope you keep listening.
And we do hope.
Who the fuck is she?
I don't know. We do hope.